Cousins, Real Four. Are we talking about your time with Len Highland Light Infantry in the, well, you were in Southend, by then. You've been promoted to Corporal, Corporal Clark, in the Headquarters Company Audley Office. What's the next thing you recall?
Next thing I recall is we received orders to move back to Billericay, the town of Billericay, which was quite a pleasant small town in those days, and the surrounding countryside was very nice. And there we were for 6 to 9 months. We had the one unfortunate incident where Jerry, one of Jerry's fighters came over and shot up the one tent that was up with our five seconded wireless telegraphy people. What were they? The REOCs. Anyway, they were a different unit.
Raw chorus signals.
And the lot, four of them got killed. Now, that's an amazing thing. Out of a whole regiment, many of us in under tents, I wasn't, but a lot of them, all the companies were under tents in Billericay, in the fields, and that one killed four of those chaps, which was awful, but that was one of these things that happened. I mean, this often happened. The Jerry would come over. It would either be a fighter or a Stuka or one of these nasty little bombers and try a little run in and back again. I mean, they were always doing this, but that was part of life. Nothing ever. We never got bombed in Billericay, fortunately. We just got shot up occasionally.
Now, how had Dunkirk affected you?
That's
a bit before that, but.
Yes. Well, that's interesting, Dunkirk. Well, as you're probably here, I can remember a lot of Dunkirk because.
Where were you when Dunkirk was about?
Ah, dear. Now, where did Dunkirk happen?
Were you still at Southend or were you at Billericay?
Still at Southend.
Right, well, what's your memory of Dunkirk?
My memory of Dunkirk was the colonel, no, the adjutant. I mean, it was always the adjutant we talked about these things, and the adjutant said, "Do you know, Cousins?" He said, "This Dunkirk business." He says, "We've had orders down from brigade. We're taking all the repatriated chaps from all the regiments," and he said, "There's an awful lot of 1st HLI. 1st HLI were out there, I believe. I think it was 1st HLI, because we were the 11th. I mean, we were the last, but the 1st and the 2nd were out, or 2nd or 3rd. Anyway, you're getting a lot of the jocks back who managed to come over, and we got the real Glasgow boys that didn't mind what they did. I mean, they'd done a lot out there. They'd seen a lot of fighting, they'd had a rough time, and we were going to, and that was, at the time I was a lance corporal in charge of a section, before I got started getting into the office. I'd been made a lance corporal, and went into that office in the company as a lance corporal, but I was in charge of a section for a few weeks, and that was when I remember, because I got five of these jocks into my section, and I began to realise what war was all about, because I would spin these stories about what they'd been through, etc., etc. But beside that, nothing really happened there at all. When I was later in the orderly room, and then I got to know that all the officers had been taken away from our regiment by, you know, doing the officers' lists. Suddenly, many of our officers were suddenly pulled out, and serving officers in the Middle East and Dunkirk were transferred into us. And this, we understood, happened all throughout Montgomery's army, the second army or something like that, right the way through, to give us the morale for future activities. And we got lots of chaps in, officers, sergeants, and you know, and they were all good chaps. I mean, they all came back, but they'd seen a lot of the first 12 months of the war, I mean, before Dunkirk. They'd had the Dunkirk and they'd managed to get back. And but they were still keen to go back and fight. And this is, so in effect, we lost, I suppose that we lost 200 or 300 men, and we had 200 or 300 fighting men into our regiment. And this happened in all regiments, I believe. I mean, certainly happened in our brigade. And it was, probably it did help us, or it was to help, well, it didn't help us because we got abandoned, but we were disbanded, unfortunately. But
yeah. What do you remember happened at Billericay?
Billericay, I was billeted in a very nice house with my other clerks.
Was it a cleared house? Or
cleared house, of course, but partly furnished, partially furnished. Good enough to put your own bed in, you know, your own palliasses in and make...
Who had owned the house? Where they go?
Well, you had an officer... I did requisitioning, which was... I learnt requisitioning in there because it came in useful when I was in Germany and all in there. But I did requisitioning. I went round...
And what was the job?
The job was to... meet the town... Well, you can't call them burgomasters. Like, burgomaster comes into mind because I'm thinking of being in Germany.
But
in Billericay, they would be the town clerk or his deputy. He would mark out a number of houses, and we would go forward from South End and look these houses over. The orderly room was the central position of two roads at the end of the high street. Most marvellous position. The orderly room was great, and the officers' quarters. They had it very nice. But we were lucky. I was 100 yards down the road in a nice three-storey older type house, which without my knowledge, I lived for 9 months opposite some very nice women, one of whom was the sister of my wife, later, whom I met, who was the English mistress and PT at the Billericay Grammar School. But because I didn't know that. But she was a lady that we subsequently knew that enjoyed officers' company, and, you know, that was that. But that was a small offshoot.
What happened when you requisitioned the billet?
Oh, we didn't. No, mainly they were people that had had enough of being on the coast or being near the coast, having this constant bombing. And when the fighting stopped with the Battle of Britain, they were jolly glad to clear out of many of the houses. Consequently, it wasn't a case of evicting anybody or asking them to move. I don't believe in any instance there was any eviction. People stayed in their properties if they were there. Local schoolmistresses were opposite, all that, and there was none of that. We were given empty houses, a few bits of furniture, quite a lot of furniture sometimes, and I think I even had a bed in that house, but it was comfortable, I know, and I enjoyed it. For 9 months, we were there. But I had to go out. Later on, that was when this is what happened. The colonel, he was getting on. He was about 55, I think, and consequently, he wasn't retiring, but they decided to move him up to London. And Major Waddell, or I called him Waddell, but Waddell. He was major, but he was second. Then he was second in command, and then he came up and became colonel. And he had me in for dictation at 200 words a minute, if he could get it out of me. And I used to sit there at him, look at him, and say, "Look, sir," I said, "I can do shorthand." I said, "You've got a marvellous brain." He was one of these IQ people, 165. Broker in a top broker in Scotland and all that, you know. He was a glorious rugby player, who every officer and man that came into the regiment had to be a big rugby pipe. You know, he ran the rugby. Always plenty of rugby in the HLI. All football, of course, but plenty of good rugby.
This was Colonel Waddell.
Waddell, yeah.
He may have been amazing. He was the Colonel.
He had it in for me, but because I was a bit cheeky to him sometimes. Whenever there was a big exercise, particularly in the snowy months, we got into November, I think. he would have me out in the truck with the office truck. He said you'll have to be out in the office truck when you're in over there. I said, all right. So we went out in the office truck. And
what would you do on these exercises in the office truck? What was the office truck?
Office truck was a 5-ton lorry constructed with benches suitable for typewriters and duplicating, for sitting down, talking, etc., etc., and making it a fairly useful office. It was a covered truck, of course, quite large and very useful. All our tin boxes, load them up straight in. I mean, we had so many moves that you did it by instinct. And you had every part of your truck. I was in front, but never drove. Although I could drive, I wasn't allowed to in those days. My driver IC, he was a clerk, but he was driver IC, and he drove everywhere. But we drove out, and Colonel Waddell used to love being out in the wilds, in the snow, he took us on a route march all around Billericay in the forest, in the snow. All of us, particularly us. I ended up in a truck after about 10 miles, in the back of a truck, got to, I think I went cramp or something. Anyway, I managed to get cramp. But that was another story, and that was our thing.
What would the office truck do during the exercises? Basically just go around with the colonel?
We go around with the colonel, and if he wanted to dictate a few notes for, say, we had to turn out part one and two orders, still in the field, because that was a necessary exercise. So we did. That kept us busy. I mean, most of my chaps smoked and sat around. I didn't smoke, but we had something to do anyway. And my orderly room sergeant never came out. He was orderly room sergeant. He stopped it back with in the office. I mean, the colonel came out, but he was in charge. He never moved anywhere. I mean, he was a chap more in his 40s, and he was...
Let's have a look then. Who was in the battalion orderly room office?
The orderly room sergeant.
Now, what was his job meant to be?
His job was meant to look after the well-being of 1,000 men and officers as far as their what are their sheets? The pay books, of course, but there was a P-54s, were it? No, something, it wasn't P-50. It was some, there were so many.
What was it?
But it was it was the form that you wrote the history of every soldier on, whether he were demoted, promoted, whether he'd gone to hospital with back trouble, as we called it, and all those. I mean, I got to know the history.
Well, we'll come to that in more detail, because this is a job you're going to do later on.
Yes. Was what the orderly room sergeant had to do, and I learned. I mean, I naturally, being under him all that time, I learned all those things. But he had to do. He had to put every detail of every man in the whole battalion on paper every day, from day to day, as the records, as the notes came in from each battalion, each company. And prepare his part one orders and give me the part two orders and all that to do.
Now, what other staff were there in the orderly room?
Sergeant Clark.
What was the Sergeant Clark's job?
His job was to do anything the orderly room sergeant passed on to him, in other words, much of it. I mean, they did the two between them, see. I mean, it became Sergeant Clark, orderly room sergeant, were one and the same.
And other staff?
Corporal Clark.
That was you.
I was me.
Corporal Clark.
Were the typists come letter writers if they could do shorthand, but I was the only one. Although the only other shorthand writer was the orderly room sergeant, and one other was the company quartermaster's sergeant.
So you had the corporal clerk, and then you had the clerk.
And we had
right.
two.
How many clerks would you have?
Three clerks, a corporal clerk, and two lance corporal clerks, and a clerk. That was about six of us all together, something. Always six of us. There's always six.
And you'd get work passed down from you from the orderly room sergeant and the sergeant clerk.
That's right, yes.
And any other personnel in the orderly office?
The RSM, when he wanted to chat.
What was the RSM?
His main job was to visit the adjutant every day, take orders from him, or get his orders. Go around the various companies, speak to the sergeant majors in charge, give them orders, etc., do a lot of verbal stuff. But in the main, he kept at headquarters. I mean, it was much better, it was much friendlier. We had cordon bleu cooks.
I thought he was responsible for discipline as well.
Discipline through his squadron, through his sergeant majors, through his company sergeant majors, and for headquarter company. He had them on parade.
Now, what about the adjutant? How would you define his role?
The adjutant was a trained officer, of course, had done all his training, but had worked himself up from second lieutenant to captain, and then found to have a legal brain and a useful mind, and been promoted to adjutant, along with the intelligence officer, who was also a captain or a lieutenant.
And what did the adjutant actually do?
Well, the adjutant in our case, in the HLI case, took everything down from the level of the colonel who'd taken it from brigadier when he went up to brigade and passed it down to us. And I mean, it all ultimately must have come from division. I mean, I never knew too much about that in those days. What happened?
Okay, that's clear. What about that? You mentioned the quartermaster sergeant. Was he part of the orderly?
No, nothing to do with the orderly room. He dealt with all the service, all the supplies, food supplies, in the whole battalion. And he was always the best chap to know. Him and the cook sergeant and the MT sergeant. They were the three sergeants you had to know if you were a sergeant in the orderly room, because you could get the extra passes.
I can see that leads you on. That's a quick review of the office. What else happened while you were at Billericay? You mentioned the exercises. What about cricket? Did you get any cricket while you were at Billericay?
No, not until our next move. No, that was
anything else at Billericay then?
Billericay.
Do you know what month you went there and what month you left?
Well, it must have been. It was in 43 I joined. January the 1st, not 43, when am I talking about? 40 when I went to do my training. March, the mystery of March down to Southend. Then the summer, a hot summer through with the Battle of Britain in Southend, and then the snows of Billericay when we went to Billericay.
So that would be November.
November. Yes, November. And then nothing unusual happened. Billericay was quite comfortable. It was a nice winter. That was another thing. We were invited out at Christmas. It was the Christmas soldier business. They did make a play about it all, but at Christmas I was invited out by this young lady whom I'd got to know through going to her shorthand class, just to pretend I didn't know shorthand, which was very enjoyable because I just acted the fool one. But it was nice. And anyway, we five of us were invited on Christmas Day to a Christmas meal at her house in Billericay, and we sat around the piano and sang and enjoyed ourselves, and that was a nice Christmas.
Now, off tape, we just had a chat, and we think you probably went to Billericay in Septemberish, rather than...
Yes,
November.
Possibly, yes.
And then you were there through till March.
Through till March, 41. Yes. And
where did you go then? You said Suffolk.
Yes. Well, we went to Suffolk, but which part of Suffolk? Oh, that's right. Now. Yes, this is... We went to Suffolk. We were told we were making for Suffolk, so we naturally got on our vehicles and the tanks went off. And we arrived at a place called, in the dark, not knowing where we were going, at a place called Glevering Hall, Glevering Hall, which... was on Sutton Common, overlooking the River Devon, where in fact the prehistoric Viking memorial was found. But that's another lot I can tell you later on. But anyway, we arrived there in the dark, and the lieutenant officer that I disliked very much. He put the ordinary room in a big house called Broxted House, Broxstead, which was on Sutton Common. Broxted House. We didn't know we were only 7 miles at that time from Woodbridge, which of course is well known, Woodbridge. But anyway, Broxted House. We were there in the dark, in a large empty mansion, plenty of room, damp, but each allotted our respective room for 4 or 5 of us. And then the thing I always remember is this officer coming in as we were getting ready to stand to. Airborne troops arriving any minute. So we thought, oh, well, this is it. And I can remember that very well, because we got our stuff back on as fast as we could, trooped out in the dark, and waited for the parachutists to come down. And we stood there till the dawn. And we were told all sorts of stories, that they'd be dressed as nuns and dressed as all sorts of things. But we never saw one parachutist. And we went back, and when we saw this officer again, we asked him where he got that warning from. And he said, oh, well, it came down from head office that we were going to have parachutists down last night. So we accepted that he wasn't playing a practical joke. And, you know, we were a bit worried about him. But anyway, that was the only time that we ever had a stand to there. Now, from there...
So you weren't at Broxted House long then?
No.
About
a couple of weeks. Which that didn't suit...
So still in March?
Well, that didn't suit... the colonel, he wanted somewhere better. So down we went and requisitioned houses in Woodbridge for only the officers. And which are now the council officers at Woodbridge, but at that time it was a lovely mansion house on the main Woodbridge Road, High Street, and it was empty. So that was fine. That was the orderly room. That was the officers' quarters. So we went to the council, requisitioned that, along with two other houses opposite that were empty, which were for myself and my Sergeant Clark, and that sort of thing. And we took up there, and that's where I met my wife. And that's where.
How did you come to meet your wife?
Well, in all the wherever we went to a church, not to the church, but to the. The reception offices and we went there, and there I Being a corporal, I got to know several young ladies there, I was a friend of the cooks are. The cook corporal at that time he was, but it had to, you know, it was policy, as I said, to be a friend of the cook corporal. But anyway, we used to go into there and we met there and they gave us tea and buns and we soon ended up playing darts and table tennis and things like that. And one particular young lady at that time, of course, she was in a play, doing a play for the troops, and I went up and said, "Oh," I said, "I wish you spoke like that all the time," which wasn't very good, because she's quite a good actress, because she's got this blotting paper memory, as I found. Anyway, I started to court her. I asked her out, I courted her for several months. And then at Woodbridge was Woodbridge. No, I didn't play cricket at Woodbridge. Oh yes, I did. It was Woodbridge. That's right. That's it. That's right.
So you were there into the summer.
I was into the summer at Woodbridge, courting this girl. But suddenly, out of the blue, Churchmans, the tobacco people in Ipswich, sent down and said, "Any of your chaps interested in cricket? We want some to make the number up." So myself and my transport officer, who was a good cricketer, said, "Well, we'd like to." Anyway, I then played for Churchmen Saturday and Sunday, much to the disgust my girlfriend. And she came along on occasions to Ipswich. Churchmen's had a beautiful ground there, outside Ipswich Station, and we played. And the managing director, a man named Harris, he played in the team, because he said to me, "I'd like you to," he said, "when the war ends," he said, "do you think you could come and work here?" Because I was knocking up the odd century and getting a lot of wickets, because it was only sort of second-class cricket, and doing very well. And because we had a regular game for the whole summer. But anyway, that was a nice. I got my whites down, and that was very pleasant. And I was courting.
Did you play the Army cricket? I know you failed.
No, not until I got into the fife and fourfer and got in the division, and then play for the division. But that's a long time ahead.
So this was just purely, in a way, private cricket.
That was normal club cricket, which they wanted a couple of people to make up, and we made. And I particularly made such an impression with the cricket that he wanted me to go and work for him after the war. And I didn't, nearly did, but that's a long story. But anyway, I enjoyed the cricket, and my wife was living opposite the Methodist church. She was a Methodist because she did Sunday school and Brownies, guides, everything. But anyway, I got to know her very well, and subsequently we became engaged. And in that summer, that was the August, that would have been the August of, you know, I do know that, 12th of August, grouse shooting day, 12th of August, and we got married.
When did you get married?
At the Methodist Church.
When?
Oh, sorry, 12th of August. When? Oh, 1942. I'm 42, I'm in now, because I didn't have my daughter till 43, so everything was above board. Yes, it was, yes, 42.
You met her in 1941?
Yes. Yes, we didn't get to Frinton until she came to Frinton later, so I couldn't have been at Frinton. After Woodbridge, I was courting her there. I hadn't got engaged, I don't think. It was a strong courtship.
So at Woodbridge, you just carried on the normal orderly room?
I carried on the normal orderly room silence, still being corporal under my sergeant, orderly room sergeant and sergeant. Oh, I got made up to Sergeant Carr.
And what difference did that make to you, would you say?
Well, that was when we got transferred back. The tanks were all up at Glevering Hall. When we were in Woodbridge, they were all up at Glevering Hall.
The men were,
with their tanks, because it was a big